Hello and welcome to another episode of Is This Just Fantasy, the podcast where two nerds get together to rate, read, and review a fantasy novel. I'm your host, Jordy Bailey.
And I'm the one using dark magic to cloud Jordy's mind so that I can become the one true ruler of this podcast, Duncan Nichol.
And welcome back to our review of the... what are they called again? The Thrawn Trilogy? Not actually a Thrawn Trilogy,
It's actually had many names over the years. I actually have a copy of one of my books that has it named as the Empire Trilogy, but it was known in the fandom as the Thrawn Trilogy for many years, but I think now we tend to call it the Heir to the Empire Trilogy. Just differentiate it from the...
Mine says Dark Force Rising, Book 2 of the Thrawn Trilogy. I'm reading from the Essential Legends Collection, and this time I didn't find any weird syntax errors.
Well, I'm glad they fixed that, Jordy, because I think your old copy, you had a lot of issues with Heir to the Empire, the first book in this trilogy.
I did, a weird number. I'm not normally one for catching stuff like that, but anyway. Yes, and if that wasn't clear enough, this is the second episode of us discussing this trilogy, and so we heartily recommend that you skip on back to the last episode, Heir to the Empire, where we cover the first part.
Yes, and this is... quite the trilogy, written by Timothy Zahn. This is set in the Star Wars universe. We have had this debate about where does Star Wars fall between fantasy and sci-fi. We are firmly in agreement that Star Wars is a fantasy series. The Force is magic.
It has wizards.
Nothing has hard science behind it. Things work because things work. Get on with it.
They sure do. Tim Fuzorn does make it seem a lot more sci-fi than the movies do because of all the, like, jargon you hear Wedge Antilles say as he's piloting, saying, like, oh no, they've got supercluster grav dragnets. I have to maneuver out of my... I have to do drag to compensate for the gravity dampeners.
It's definitely something that there's a bit of back and forth between the authors that kind of write Star Wars book. Like, Timothy Zahn definitely sits on that more hard sci-fi end of it. Yet you've got other people like Kevin J. Anderson, who you may know as the man who wrote all of Benny Jean sequels, who is just like, nope, just seat of the pants. This is full on fantasy. I do not care how this stuff is working. He really kind of takes it to the other end of the spectrum. And other guys who literally wrote the Dathomir witches and called them witches. It's like, it's magic. It's just another name for the Force. Mm. And you go, okay, that's how it works.
Fair enough, yeah. I mean, a moth does call Darth Vader a wizard in the first movie. So, yeah, they're magicians. Actually, I was going to ask this last time, but I kind of slipped my mind. You talked about how these books rank very highly in terms of the... Star Wars Legends books, you know, these are considered some of the best. How does Kevin J. Anderson rank?
Oh, not nearly as highly. Kevin J. Anderson didn't write nearly, maybe did actually write a similar amount to Timothy Zahn, but he's not as beloved in the fandom. Some of his works are quite good, but he's mostly known for writing the Jedi Academy trilogy, which I like, but okay. Definitely has some really dumb moments. Like, I'm talking about, I think it's like a 3-year-old getting puppeted by the Force to use a lightsaber. And he also introduced full-on Force ghosts. Not like ghosts as in, we see ghosts in the old trilogy, but I'm talking like evil spirits that haunt haunt graveyards levels of Force ghosts. But...
okay.
But he also wrote the Young Jedi Knight series, which is a young adult spin on it. And I think he does do a really good work with the characters. You know, he's not a bad writer. I just don't think he quite got the same end of the stick of the Star Wars universe. And for that, he's not really given the same level of prestige as some of the other writers. But he is nowhere near the bottom, by the way, that I want to make clear.
Okay, so... okay, so, before we crack on into Dark Force Rising, Duncan, have you been reading anything else in between?
I have indeed, a little bit, kind of. I don't really want to super talk about it, because I have not finished the book yet. Geordie, for the first time, I was kind of ahead of schedule. Doesn't happen a lot. So, I finally, after like 18 months, have got back into the Expanse series. But
very good.
And it is... oh, it's so well written. Geordie, I was up to the fourth book, Cibola Burn, and I enjoyed it. I've loved every Expanse book I've read so far. They're not all equal, but I've loved them all, and I'm just starting Nemesis Games. And I don't know how to put this. I don't want to put down anything that we've read, but certainly going from Timothy Zahn's Star Wars tie-in sci-fi to jump over to the Expanse, I don't want to say it's night and day, but it's good in such a different way.
It's true. It's really cutting edge, you know, pristine, all the edges honed off writing, especially Nemesis Games, which is a really good one.
It definitely just, for me, the Expanse of what I've read so far, it just reeks of an authorship that knows what they're doing and where they're going and what they want each book and the series as a whole to be. Like, and I don't know anything about the behind the scenes. Maybe it's not the case, but certainly to a reader, a first-time reader, that's the impression I get, that this author, or these authors, is a shared authorship, if I'm not mistaken.
That's correct.
It's like the pseudonym for, like, two blokes. But
yeah,
they just have such a sense of, like, every scene is doing something, and I'm being efficient. If it's the emotional work, pushing the plot forward, even if it's not like high-tail action, it's all these moving parts, and they all always click together so beautifully. It's truly...
That's true, and I don't even think the series is as coherently planned out as you're sort of talking about, speaking to like the next like two or three books. But you're right in that it feels effortless. They do feel like they fit together like puzzle pieces.
And something else that I really like about The Expanse, sorry, not to completely derail, but this one I really do appreciate in longer running series, something that I would have really liked maybe a bit more when perhaps when I was reading like Wheel of Time. I feel like each book has such a strong identity and beginning, middle and end, and a sense of escalation. Sure. Like I stopped reading after Super Elevator because like, cool, that was perfect and done.
Yeah, for sure. I almost felt the same way about the book right before Sibylla Burn, where you know, you're like, okay, we did it, right? I mean, there's stuff to explore and what happens next, but that could be the end of a series. Each book is one way, it's like episodes of Friends. You can say, it's the one where that happens, you know? And there could be no confusion about what you're talking about. I mean, like, take, for example, Dark Force Rising. They are so coherent and they flow together, this trilogy, so completely because they feel like one singular story arc that just happens to have been broken up. So much so that in our last episode, you revealed a plot point on accident because you thought it was in the previous book.
I know, I felt very embarrassed about that, but that is definitely, you know, talking about these two comparison points. And like, that's not bad. I'm not saying one's necessarily better than the other. I do certainly think if you're writing a very, very long series, it is nice for it to be a little bit more segmented. But yeah, there's something where we're looking at Heirs to the Emperor, the Thrawn trilogy. It does read like it's one big book. If someone gave this to me in like a big, thick volume, to be fair, it wouldn't even be that thick in like the grand scale of some of the things out there. I'd be like, cool. That's the sequel to Star Wars.
Yeah, sure.
But Geordie, enough about me.
I can tell Duncan really wants to crack on and get talking about the book, but I'll very briefly say that I've also been on a bit of a sci-fi kick. I've just read the third book in the Numena series by Lindsay Ellis, Apostles of Mercy. So it's the follow-up to her other books about alien contact, and it was really fantastic. I did a review of it on our Instagram, which you can find. Is This Just Fantasy Podcast? But yeah, heartily recommend. Really, really solid stuff. The relationships are coming together so well.
I'm not super familiar. Is this her like first outing as an author, just her first sci-fi outing, or not any of that?
This is her first outing as an author. She's been, the first book came out in 2020, I believe. Axiom's End, followed up by The Truth of the Divine. It's a series about alien first contact, and the aliens are, like, really alien. Like, they don't even have skin, they're, like, cyborgs, but nonetheless, it's about communication, communication with something that is truly alien and trying to understand it, and themes around how in trying to understand something you can make yourself more like the thing you are trying to comprehend. And it's a fantastic series. It's about society and it's about politics and it's about falling in love with cyborg aliens.
That sounds really lovely. Something that I always liked in sort of some of the classic, maybe not classic Star Trek, Star Trek Next Gen, was those episodes where it was focused upon communication and trying to engage with like an alien life form who don't interact. It always disappointed me when we sort of skip over the first contact in the Star Trek universe. I'm like, how did Vulcans and humans first get like, okay, we now speak a common language, literally?
It's the only episode which could possibly come close would be something like the classic Darmok. But yeah, it's the aliens in Axiom's End, that whole series, really are like, so there's a fantastic bit. I'll just say this very briefly, which is that not only are they like mostly metal, they're not even very meat-based anymore. They developed, they evolved as vegetarians. Not even vegetarians, herbivores. So when they're on this planet, they're like, I'm on a planet of 7 billion meat-eating aliens. And that's terrifying, despite the fact that they're super highly advanced. We eat meat, and that's horrifying!
Yes, Geordi, it really is. Think on that.
Shut up. You're one of us. They won't spare you when it's time for the purge.
Okay, back to Star Wars and the Dark Force Rising. Not Dark Forces, which I continuously get it confused the title for. That's the Star Wars video game.
There is a singular Dark Force.
So, this story, and we said like we've already kind of given mild spoilers to our thoughts on it. It's very much a natural continuation of the Heir to the Empire. Geordi, just quickly.
Which we enjoyed.
Did you continue to enjoy it, or did this drop the ball?
I did continue to enjoy it. I continue to enjoy it in much the same way that I enjoyed the previous book. I think that I, in fact, enjoyed it more. Not an immense amount more, because it was quite similar, but there were changes to it, which I enjoyed. So, for example, in the last book, Mara Jade and Luke Skywalker, it's nice to see them in those scenes where they're working together. It's much more satisfying and enjoyable in this book where they're working together.
I quite agree. I think this book has a much stronger climax compared to the previous one. And what this book also does, two real key things. One is it explores sort of the alternative villain of this series a lot more, the Dark Jedi figure, referenced in the intro. Mm-hmm. But also, Geordi, we get so much more Leia now.
Yes.
Very happy about this.
Let's begin there.
Right, Leia. Not in the first book, an awful lot. Not nothing bad.
No, not enough.
Just not a lot. And this book brings Leia in and gives her her own plot line, which I think exemplifies what this character, in my mind at least, like can and should be.
Mm-hmm.
She is the negotiator. What ends up happening, Leia is taken by this species of alien, whose name has actually, the Noguri. Noguri?
Mm-hmm. Noguri, yeah.
Taken by this species. Now, this species is currently working with Thrawn. You know, they're his special hit squad. They are loyal to him. But one of them reaches out to him and is like, listen, come back to my homeworld. I want to have a little chat with you. And what we just...
I want to stop you right there. And most of what you said is correct, but I really want to emphasize something. She is not taken and she is not invited. She chooses to go. This is completely directed by her.
You're absolutely right, and that you're right. That is a very important distinction to make. She chooses to go because she wants to reach out to them. She wants to be, that's why right. Are you just following this guy? And what I even like in this bit, when she kind of goes, because I think originally they're like, okay, you can come, but you come alone. And she's just like, no, I'm bringing Chewbacca.
Yeah, absolutely. Chewbacca was not going to be left alone. She's like, listen, you're gonna have to play ball with me. I'm bringing along my Wookiee and my translation robot.
Very reasonable ask. I also love it how the Noguri are like, is it a life debt? And she's like, yeah. And they're like, fair dues. We get ya.
Yeah, we totally get it. Come on. We have those two. All right, come along.
And in this plot, she goes down and she finds out not only the history of these people, but also their relationship to Darth Vader. And we actually get a bit of exploration about her relationship to Darth Vader. Something that is very much skimmed over in the original trilogy.
That's true.
So... Geordie, that's the premise. I'm almost like, where do I go next? There's so many good moments of Laird being kind of a diplomat.
Exactly. And the great thing about the diplomat is that there's this really difficult problem to overcome. Her objective is stop working for the Empire. They're the bad guys. And if you want to, you are not obliged to, but if you want to, you can join us in the New Republic. And the conflict that prevents that from happening, because they revere Darth Vader, and the reason why they revere Darth Vader is that their planet was substantially damaged by an atmospheric battle between the Empire and the Rebellion. And the Rebellion ship crashed onto this planet and like poisoned the atmosphere and did huge amounts of damage. And the Empire has been like tidying up the planet. So they owe the Empire a great debt. And to repay that debt, they give up their sons as warriors for the Empire. They serve Darth Vader. The reason why Leia is permitted to come to the planet is that they recognize her by her scent as the daughter of Darth Vader. So the challenge is, this is kind of our fault. We were the ones in that battle with the Empire, and the Empire will never claim responsibility for what happened, but we're good, moral people, so we have to bear the blame for what happened, and that means that there doesn't seem to be any way to get them to change sides, or at least stop supporting the Empire.
And this kind of plays out, we keep cutting back to the story throughout the whole book. Leia is very much segregated from the rest of the narrative events while this is going on. Now, Geordie, there's a little bit in this, which I do, always makes me chuckle a little bit, okay? I think it's funny that they call her Lady Vader.
Yeah, it is a bit funny, isn't it?
And I always wondered, like, is that just meant to be sort of a Naguri-ism? Like, their understanding? Or is this actually a bit of a Timothy Zornism? Is he like, yeah, so was Vader Darth Vader's actual last name? So they're recognising her as one of the Vader family? Or
I took it to be a Naguri-ism. However, something I did think was a Zornism is the fact that Luke is referred to as Jedi Skywalker. Like, Jedi is used in the way that we now would say Master. Like, they hadn't figured out that was the appropriate way to address him yet. So they just say, Jedi this, Jedi that.
Oh, that's good. I don't think I'd actually super picked up on that, but you're absolutely right. That's something that we have very much phased out. I love this early days stuff. And there's quite a few hints, particularly later on when we do get to those cloning tanks. Oh, loves it. Star Wars retconning is almost as fun as the actual plot. So we get this kind of setup, and we're just, you know, because it's so good, let's focus down Leia's plot all the way to sort of the end of the book. So I really enjoy the fact that she's trying to bring them on board. There's loads of interaction. She interacts with loads of different ones, like the village elder. She's talking to the one she's trying to bring inside. In between, she's trying to just be nice to them and be like, look, I'm friendly. There's some great scenes where that she has to hide, which I really love. I love the fact that, you know, we go from Luke, who's quite a strong, capable character in a lot of this, to like, okay, Leia, you just need to hide in the blooming roof tiles. You cannot be seen. There is a problem.
Yeah, and she's hiding specifically from Thrawn, and he's a character we know is really hard to get past, to trick. So the scenes where they do have to like trick him and lie to him, he's seeing through some of the deceptions, but they just managed to get away by the skin of their teeth. And the fact that he's been so ably set up as this perceptive, discerning villain means that scenes where they have to hide are like really nerve-wracking. Like, you really surprise how much they're able to get away with it. I do think that as much as we both enjoyed Leia's storyline in this, it does take her out of a narrative for a lot of the story. Granted, she's still doing things, she's contributing, and she's successful in the end. And I think it really justifies itself by its denouement when she reveals, like, she solves the riddle. Like, she gets to the truth of the matter at hand, and she's able to present a case and, like, win. Like, she succeeds in her mission.
See, Okay, Jody, you've just spoken about that in a very positive way. So, spoilers here. I found this a little bit disappointing because there was a bit of me that was hoping that she would find some of a philosophical, ethical grounds to sort of win over the Noguri. What we get is she basically pulls back the facade and goes, oh no, look, the Empire are not helping you because they're evil and they don't help anyone. There's this big reveal.
Isn't that philosophical, like to reveal the Empire is bad? Like it's saying like, we're not the Empire?
That's a good question. I think it would be different if she sort of went, listen, the Empire are only helping you to take your sons as warriors, rather than the Empire aren't actually helping you.
I don't know. I mean, I don't think your answer is any worse or maybe better than the one that's presented in the book. I can see your point in that it's not an ideological victory for the Republic, because it merely points out that, you know, the Empire is devious. But I also think that in terms of it being like, the Empire is hoisted on its own petard. You know, they wouldn't be losing if they weren't being dishonest. Like, they wouldn't, this wouldn't matter if Leia was just as devious and just as scheming as the Empire, because she would try to exploit them right back. And instead she says, you don't have to join us, but you shouldn't follow them anymore. I think there is a difference there. And I think that, I just think in particular, the fact, the way in which the mystery is unfolded, the way you have that moment of like, say that again? How long has this been going on? And I think that's really, really interesting. Again, something that does not line up with canon's Star Wars, because the big unveiling is that in a conversation, it's revealed to her just completely naturally that the incident that they referred to took place much longer ago than she'd been led to believe, 44 years, whereas she thought it was like 5 years ago. And she says 44 years, that means that the fight, that was the Clone Wars, when of course we know that was like at most 30 years ago.
25 like years ago?
19 years, BBY is the end of the Clone Wars. How long was it going on for, like 5 years?
Let's say that. Clone Wars is a 5 year long conflict.
And then 5 more years, because this is 5 years after Yavin. Sorry, not Yavin, after Endor.
Correct. And then the interim time, which I think is about 3 years. Some Star Wars fans are raging at this point because we're probably well off the mark. But you're quite right. 30 years, 33. There's certainly not an extra 10 to be found somewhere.
Yeah, so that's a funny one where they're like, how long ago was the Clone Wars? Long enough ago that Obi-Wan was probably a young man when he fought in it. So 40 years. 44 years. There we go. That's good.
True. There's definitely an element, just focusing on that, where they really kind of set up the Clone Wars, the fall of the Jedi, and the rise of the Empire as these, I think, like three very distinct events. Whereas I think in the prequels, it's basically shown as happening in one night.
Well, yeah, because it has to fit into one movie.
You're right, we have that there. And you're right, that's a really nice scene. And the reveal moment, you go, oh my life. And also, it's not something that you wouldn't buy, if you know, taking the prequels out of this, going back to when this was written, perfectly reasonable assumption. You know, Obi-Wan looked about 60. I don't know how exactly how old, you know, Guinness was, but sounds reasonable. He was a young man who's in his 20s. Cool, it's 40 years ago.
You fought in the Clone Wars? Also, it did occur to me while I was reading this book, they're always referred to as the Clone Wars, plural. Like, we see a Clone War, but that implies that there should be multiple of them, right?
Does indeed. I can only make the counter argument that you would consider each like planet as like big enough to be called its own war.
No, they're each a different front. And I know that because they named video games after them.
Yeah, fair enough. You're right. It does make it seem that there's a variety of Clone Wars. Maybe this is a period of multiple clone uprisings and different factions.
The Second World Wars, because we refer to the Western Front and the Sino-Japanese War and the Russian War of Patriotism, all as separate wars for some reason.
Yeah, fair play. Again, another fact. But I do think Luke calls it, he fought during the Clone War.
The. Definitely plural.
I am rewatching the movie.
Anyway, that's completely off topic.
Completely off topic.
So.
Vaguely off topic. Dark Force Rising. Yes, so Leia. Good. Thumbs up. Really like that she's here. And it definitely feels like Timothy Zahn wasn't neglecting her in the first book. Like, he knew where she was going to shine in this trilogy and was just having to be like, okay, sorry.
He was telling him to buy time for when she could do anything in the first book. Like, there's definitely the scene on Kashyyyk where she's, like, swinging from vines. That's make work. You know, that's a scene. It did not need to be there. It doesn't add anything to the book. It just had to sort of... She had to do something. We can't have her do absolutely nothing in the first book, so let's find something cool for her to do. Also, we finally get an answer to the question I was looking for. Her lightsaber is green.
Yes, and my comic book was blue.
For shame, comic book. Read a book, you nerds. All right, so we covered Leia's arc, and we have... How many... three other storylines that weave through this. Han and Lando get their own series of loops they need to jump through, which does actually tie together much better than I was expecting. They were going from place to place so much on a bit of a goose chase, but they really did all come together in the end, and I was impressed by that. Luke has his journey to find Joris Sabaoth, but actually... surprising to me, that did not go the way I expected either, because I thought what was going to happen was it would just be a very simple Jedi-focused section. He would vanish off like he does in Empire, and he would be dealing with the Jedi stuff. So in Empire, he meets with Yoda, and then he leaves Yoda, and he deals with Vader. So his two things is focusing on the Jedi stuff. But actually... it's much more thematically focused because Luke has a really clearly defined arc in this, which is begun in the previous book, but is really amped up here, which is, what does it mean to be a Jedi? He has to figure that out. No one is going to teach him. Certainly not Joris Sabaoth.
I really like this as a character arc for Luke. Not only because it's great for the character, but it's great for the audience to go, yeah, what is a Jedi? Other than a good person that wields a lightsaber, what do they do? What do they believe?
Absolutely. I mean, that central conflict is right there in Return of the Jedi, where Obi-Wan and Yoda both want Luke to strike down his own father. Which... is understandable if dogmatic. He's an evildoer. He must be stopped. But he's also this boy's father. And he believes he can be redeemed. Luke's triumph in Return of the Jedi is in some ways surpassing the old order and redefining what it might mean to be a Jedi. So in this book, when you see that go further, where he's doing things where... you know, like, he has to do something illegal in, like, his first chapter to get his X-Wing repaired so he can return to Coruscant. And then later, he is asked to be an arbitrator, to be wise like King Solomon, and to hear people out. That's, like, one of my favorite scenes in the book, because I'm like, oh my god, I can't believe that Luke is just straight up being asked, you need to be an adjudicator. And that's not a scene I've ever seen from Luke before. So it was really interesting to see such a change of pace for him.
And not to go off topic again from this book, but I always think this is a really nice fact that Timothy Zahn did not know about, but it actually plays the looseness that Luke doesn't know what the Jedi are meant to be. Actually really plays with the prequels that we eventually get. Because not only is it like, well, if Luke's not like those Jedi, it's both twofold. Should he be? And... obviously not, because he just doesn't know. Because they probably aren't recorded in the public library what they used to do.
I really like the depiction of Jedi, or at least what Luke is making the Jedi into as best he can. And the fact that there is deliberate parallelism between the way Luke is asked to arbitrate between people, and he listens and he hears them out, and he has to jump through hoops and go back and forth, and has this very lateral approach where he's doing everything he can in the same way that a Jedi never attacks, where he's never too prescriptive, he's never too authoritarian. He never says, you must do this because I say so. He goes out of his way to try and find ways to make it work for everyone as best he can. And then he meets with Joris Sabaoth, who uses his mind control powers and his lightning powers to make people do what he wants. He's a fascist.
And it's almost like this kind of sense of, this is what makes a dark Jedi and what makes a light one. It's not about wearing a big black cape and ruling an empire. It's a very fundamental idea of, are you going to impose on other people because you have this power, or are you going to help them?
I remember us having the same discussion back in Revenge of the Sith, where you, Duncan, have a much more, I don't know how to put it, like, there should be different.
It's called the Unifying Force theory, Geordie. It's covered extensively in the New Jedi Order.
So there is one
series. But yes, I think you'll find it's a popular school among the foremost of the Solo children.
That being?
Spoilers.
No, I'm not saying what is the Solo children. I'm saying, what does the Unifying Force mean?
It basically means that the Force, there is no dark and light side to the Force. They're not two literal entities. The Force is the Force. It is just an energy field. All that the dark and light is really is just the use of the individual. You know, there is no dark sword. A sword's a sword, mate. It's how you wield it that matters.
And I disagree. I think there is a dark side, and it's bad, and it's evil, and it makes you do naughty things.
And I will also say that that kind of theory, by and large, is shot down in canon. But it was there for a bit, so I cling to it, because I think it's the better interpretation. I find that way more fun than that kind of video gamey, there's two bars, and you get dark force points and light force points.
Yeah.
I would say, and I think this book lends itself to that interpretation, but it doesn't restrict itself either. Definitely very clear that firing lightning is a no-no.
Yeah. I do think I remember someone telling me once that, like, one of the Jedi masters on the Jedi Council in the prequels can shoot lightning, but good? It might be Plo Koon, I'm not sure.
Don't. It's the same thing when you go back to, like, Mace Windu, and they're like, yes, his lightsaber is purple because it mixes light and dark, and I'm like, oh, come off it.
I hate it. And I see you, motherfuckers. I see you be like, oh, the one Jedi on the council who's a human who's black is the one who strays closest to the dark side. Go fuck yourselves. Oh, his fighting style is the most aggressive. Fuck off. Suck my dick, you racist cunts.
Obviously, that's one interpretation. There are many other ways to look at it. But yes, I think this more kind of flexible approach, because ultimately, when people that do that argument, it's that kind of slippery slope. I use Force Lightning, but only for good. I'm like, that's the whole point. They think they're doing something good. Joris Sabaoth, in this, I think generally thinks he's doing the right thing. He's that kind of a villain. He's like, I am bringing order. I'm using my wisdom to put them in their place. I'm dispersing the chaos.
He is one of those people, but he's also canonically completely insane.
Also true. But from his own standpoint,
yes,
that he, you know, he's not...
Oh, from my perspective, the Jedi are evil.
Well, he's not Palpatine. You know, who I feel like ultimately is like, yes, I am evil. Ha 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 ha.
I'm so fucking bad and I love it.
This guy at least is vaguely thinking, yeah, I'm a good guy. You're weird for not doing it my way.
Yeah, but again, he's another authoritarian. Like, the reason why he thinks that he's helping people is that he thinks all of non-Force users are lesser. He's like a Jedi racist. He's like, we are superior. We are more worthy. We should be in charge of people because, well, the Force chose us for a reason, didn't it?
Yes, and that's a great little tidbit, which I don't think it's explored much. The idea of the Force chooses who's sensitive to them, the will of the Force. Which is actually something that does go against my theory, because you're like, they do talk about, you know, the will of the Force to a certain extent. You're like, wait, so it is sentient. Does it have an overarching will?
Are there any squibs in the Skywalker clan? Are there any kids who don't get Force powers?
I'm going to go with no.
Yeah. That's another, alright, tick a box in the midichlorian section.
So, back to Luke's story arc. He goes and he studies under Joris. And I really like the fact that Luke, I think, very initially is a little bit like, wait, is that how I'm meant to do it?
Yeah, I really like this because this is so confusing to begin with. You see Joris obviously being a bad guy, and then you're like, Luke, why aren't you doing anything? You're just standing by and you're just listening to this guy. And you get completely, at least in my experience, you get completely hoodwinked. And you don't get why Luke isn't doing this. And it's only when Mara Jade shows up on the planet and she sees it from the outside where she goes, and you see Luke's behavior through her eyes, you go, oh, his brain is being fogged by the dark side. Like, Joris is trying to slowly whittle him down with Jedi mind control.
A really nice reveal. And it is something that I think does play on your mind, because part of that original trilogy arc, not massively, but certainly there in Return of the Jedi, is will Luke fall to the dark side? He has a bit of his father in him. And to see that in this book before Mira Jade shows up, and you're like, oh, are we playing with that again? Is Luke a little bit like, God, I wish I could actually just tell them what to do? Do you know what? Those annoying senators, when I get back, be a zappy zappy. Problem solved. And then we can go fight Thrawn. Everyone wins. Like, I think that's a very valid direction to think that is where we're going. Obviously, with the greater context, definitely not happening. And I'm very happy when we get that reveal. And Mira Jade shows up. And I do like that Luke, you know, he does snap out of it. And he is still fundamentally the same good Luke. We're not subverting the character. And then it's made by making it very clear that Joris is affecting him with mind control. You can then get to hand wave and go, oh, good. Oh, good. He's fine. He's not really evil.
Mm. Yeah, and when that threat is introduced in the first book, you never take it seriously, being like, oh, I will lead Luke to the dark side. You're like, I don't think you will. I don't think he will. We kind of did that already. He won with flying colors. He actually brought someone else back from the dark side when someone tried to turn him. So I really don't think this is going to work, man. You might want to rethink your plans.
But I do think he makes a much better attempt at it than the Emperor ever does. Like, I never got what the Emperor's plan was. He's like, yes, once you kill your father, you will then serve me. I'm like, mate, he's going to kill you both. Like, if Luke is here to kill you, he's not going to stab Vader and go...
Again, that goes down to my end, because once he does kill not just Vader, but his father, he will have succumbed to the dark side because he will have done too many bad guy points and he won't be able to turn back.
Fine, not how I see it, but whatever.
Palpatine knows what he's talking
about. He probably does. He strikes me as a man in control until he's very much not. But he always has a backup plan, Geordi.
Mm.
He's got clones.
He always does, even if it has to be 6 movies later.
So...
Alright, so...
Right, Mira Jade shows up.
Duncan, the book is called Dark Force Rising. What is Dark Force? We haven't talked about it.
The Dark Force, the Katana Fleet. Introduced in the last book.
Yeah, fuck. Alright, we already have to stop. It's really cringe that it's called the Katana Fleet.
Is it? That's how I associate it.
Yes. It's the Japanese sword fleet. Like, it's clearly that Timothy Zahn was like, What's cool? Katanas are cool. Yeah. It's called the Katana Fleet. Hell yeah.
What would you have preferred?
Anything. It's just lame. It's just like, yeah, I'm really going to get... Because here's the thing. Back in 1993, I'm sure this wasn't. Like, most people probably didn't know what a katana was because the Japanese movies were all dubbed at that point, right? anime wasn't a big thing yet. Like, Akira has come out, but that's about it. You've seen My Neighbor Totoro, maybe? But yeah, like, that was not a common parlance, or it hadn't been completely memed out as the super-duper samurai sword.
No, you're quite right. And from a lore perspective, it is much more like, surely these fleets are just numbered. Surely you just say the 7th fleet or the 4th division. It's like, no, this was the badass one. Yeah, we're building the badass fleet. It's called the Katana fleet. Are katanas a thing? I think they are actually a thing. But are they called katanas?
Yes, katana is the Japanese word for sword.
The sword fleet.
To be honest, I can imagine the dark side having a scimitar fleet. Like, that does sound like something that would exist.
I would remind you that this is a universe where the leading evil ship is the Death Star.
Yes. Yes. Nonetheless, it's like, this is just a Japanese word. Like, it's not a proper noun. That's a word that means sword in Japanese. Anyway, I think it's a bit lame, but...
I don't. But you're right, the Dark Force is this secret fleet. Now, I really like this introduction of this fleet and the Dark Force, mainly because we actually get kind of the science behind it, the very weak science behind it, actually gets introduced to us kind of completely off bat. Because this fleet, here's the background, people. During the time of the High Republic, or the Old Republic, whatever you want to call it, a big fleet was built, and they were all hooked up with slave circuits, so they could all be, centrally controlled. A system, by the way, that's introduced in the first book, but in a completely different context, to, guide ships into land.
Yes, that's actually really, snappy writing right there, to introduce this idea through Lando, who has no idea it's about to be relevant to the rest of the series. But yeah, that's good setup and payoff.
Something went wrong and the entire fleet simultaneously went to hyperspace. And the old pilot was like, oh sod. We've just lost an entire...
We lost 200 ships.
It's one of those things where you're like, okay, I feel like the hunt to find them would have happened a hell of a lot sooner. People are like, guys, where did they go? We need...
My problem is not that... people didn't look for them, because they say very clearly they did. It's like a big treasure hunt. It's like the search for the Ark of Covenant. But what is a bit weird is a smuggler finding them 20 years ago and then not telling anyone or making any move to sell them in the intervening years.
Yes, he waits until after the Empire's basically fallen, and then he's like, oh, shall I sell it to some of the remaining factions? Like, dude, surely during the Rebellion, you would have rocked off and been like, okay, Rebel Alliance, where's that blank check?
Yeah, you want this. Give me all of Alderaan before it explodes, okay?
And I'm not going to lie, in sort of Rebel Alliance terms, I think that genuinely would have been a trade they would have been like, okay, we can make that work. Just name your planet, mate.
We might be able to do this. Listen, they already have a Viceroy. We can just swap them out, right? We need these ships. We need them real bad. It's interesting. So what I love about this book is, Duncan, something you said in the last episode, is that it's not a super weapon. It's just a large number of ships. That's all.
Yes, and it's kind of great because it kind of shows that the factions are fighting differently. I like the idea that Thrawn's like, I'm not building a super weapon. We've tried that twice. It didn't end well.
And we can't, even if we wanted to. Thrawn doesn't have the resources. He's saying, and I like this, he's saying numerous times in his book, I'm in charge of the Empire. I'm the guy in control. And I don't think in the previous book he was as explicit about that. He was obviously the most important dude, but I don't think he was being as clear about the fact that he is now the central authority, and you have to just listen to him. But he couldn't make Death Stars if they wanted to, because he owns a shadow of what the Empire previously was. He and the New Republic are essentially scrabbling for the scraps of prior wars, because that's what needs to make the difference.
It's really nice to see this kind of levelling of the playing field. One thing that we get throughout the original trilogy, and we go again in the sequels, is the idea that we're following the rookies, the underdogs. You know, they don't... The plucky guys. Exactly. They don't have the resource. They can't do it. The overwhelming force, somehow, with the First Order. But I really like the fact that it's level now. It's like, okay, we can't... The Empire just can't do an all-out attack. Like, they know where they are. They're on Coruscant. And they're like, we don't have the resources. We need to find more ships.
That's really great.
And so this is the treasure hunt. And this is what you're kind of hoping for. They're going to pick up. Most of the novel is about who's going to get to these ships first. Because it's very much set up. Mm. Whoever gets them... Well, it's going to tip the balance in the war.
And what's great about it is that, just like in a previous book, it's all about whittling down Thrawn's advantage. And the things... So Thrawn is set up so well in the first book as being this almost indomitable intellect. Like, you can't outthink him. He is the smartest guy in the book. So they can't do anything smarter than him. But it can win these tiny little victories. Like Leia... getting the Nogiri onto her side, that doesn't bear fruit in this book, but you can bet it's going to in the next one. And they don't manage to get the 200 ships, they lose. It's the second book in a Star Wars trilogy, so obviously it has to go wrong, but they lose. He gets the ships, but he doesn't get all of them. They get 15 of them. He only gets... 182 ships.
Makes all the difference.
I was really hoping that they'd find the Dark Force and they'd be like, oh, these ships don't work. they straight up are old and broken down and decrepit.
I would have loved that, actually. Or at least just being outdated. Like, they just get them and go, oh yeah, they're 40 years old.
These are pre-Clone War. These could be 60 years old. How much... And granted, we see, like, the galaxy span, like, 20,000 years of history, and the technology does not change that much. So maybe 60 years is really small. It's like iPhone releases apart in terms of technological changes.
I think that's definitely meant to be the vibe you should take away from this. But there's another element to the fleet, which is really interesting. They go, there's a fleet of 200 ships. How are we going to crew them?
Yeah.
Another great question. What's the manpower resource? Thrawn's in the same boat. You know, every man he has, guess what? He's probably already, you know, manning one of his existing Star Destroyers. So what's he going to do?
Yeah.
Geordi?
That's the big reveal at the end of this book, which fortunately I wasn't too clued in by your spoiler, but thankfully for Joris Saboev already being introduced as a clone. But yes, cloning vats, Spartai cloning vats, the stormtroopers that will be serving, or maybe already are, serving under Thrawn are clones. They're not free, independent stormtroopers anymore. They're clones. I'm really interested to see what cloning looks like under Timothy Zorn's eyes instead of George Lucas. Here's a little thing, Duncan. I never watched the Clone Wars cartoon. I certainly never watched anything like The Bad Batch. The most exposure I've had to clones outside of the prequel trilogy was playing Star Wars Battlefront 2. And I'm referring to Star Wars Battlefront 2 on the PlayStation 2.
Classic. 501st.
The 501st Legion. Yeah, the 501st Legion. So, the 501st Legion was really being moved around a lot in that war, by the way. Like, that's a lot of different fronts to fight on.
But when you're the best, you needed what you needed.
But yes, the point being that I've not actually had a lot of exposure to clones as characters. I know Commander Cody, because he's that one guy who talks to Obi-Wan in that one scene, but I don't know who the fuck this Rex guy is.
He is a badass and the favourite, and he is a darling, and no one shall hurt him. That's who Rex is, Captain Rex. So you're very right. You've only seen very limited exposure. The idea of the clones, I'm just going to say now, is drastically different. Like, on a very ideological level. In fact, there's an element, moving in a little bit maybe into The Last Command, where one of the key things that we get when we do the Clone Wars and Clone Wars anime series, I have seen it all, by the way, and The Bad Batch, not the most recent season, but I'll get there eventually. is the idea that these clones are like, yes, you come from the same genetic material, but you're basically just brothers. Like, you're not anywhere different than if your mum had just had 20,000th quadrant, whatever that word is, Lutz. Like, you're all still human.
How many clones do they make in, like, Attack of the Clones? Like, a million?
So, the exact quote is, I think it's 200,000 units already, and a million more well on the way. That's the line. But people have gone in there and gone, yeah, but what's a unit? Is a unit one clone? Or is he saying a unit as in a battalion or a squad?
A squadron, yeah, that makes sense. Because 1. However million of clones is, like, tiny. That's a fraction of the Earth's arms force.
Exactly. Forces. People point out, like, on a galactic war that Clone Wars are meant to happen, that's nothing. One thing that is brought up...
And there are trillions of droids. There are trillions of droids.
Yes. And one thing that's kind of brought up is the fact that that's what we get at the start of Attack of the Clones, but it's very much implied throughout the Clone Wars that, no, this was a continuous manufacturing process. Like, it took them a while to set up, but they were pumping them out throughout the entire Clone War to meet demand.
That's probably true, but... look at the Soviet army in World War II. The largest number is when the first mustering happens. Like, you have an initial batch, and it's probably never going to get bigger than that initial batch. Once you start drafting people, the number skyrockets. So it goes in, like, the Russian war from, like, 10 million to 34 million. And then by the end of the war, it's 12 million.
You're absolutely right, Geordie, but this isn't drafting people. This is rifle production. This is scaling up factory to mass manufacture. You start out, how many guns, you know, are we putting out coming off the factory line at the start of the war? Okay, a war's on, how many guns you start rolling out of the factory?
You're somewhat right, but, like, they still have to be grown.
There is accelerated aging involved. But yes, the...
I know that, but they still have to be grown.
Well...
How quickly does a clone grow up?
If I'm not mistaken, I think the idea is that they're on, like, a 5x accelerated rate. So it takes 4 years to hit 20, you know, and be fighting ready. Maybe you can cut it short to, like, 3 and a bit years if you really have to.
That means... You get one batch. You get one batch at the beginning. And then, the Clone Wars might be like 5 years. You get one more batch, right?
I think it's more the idea. It's the fact that, like, you put down your first harvest. You sow your first seeds on week one. And your second bunch of seeds on week two. And your next bunch of seeds on week three. So you stagger out the planting.
Fair enough. That's true.
And then you stagger out the harvest.
Yeah. I will say this. When it comes to armies of clones, I am going to prefer the Jem'Hadar from Star Trek.
You're actually going to have to fill me in on what that is.
We'll talk about that off mic. It's not relevant to this one. But, so, clones are coming. They aren't even in the story yet. I mean, I guess they are right at the end, but I have yet to grapple what that means. We will have to talk about that next time. But in the book we have, so we were talking about Luke and his arc. We talked about the Dark Force, which is what Han and Lando are looking for, and they go in a bit of a chase to try and find it. And
it's very light.
It takes them to different places.
I feel Han and Lando, they don't really have any big kind of emotional moments. They're not really carrying that. They're mostly, in my opinion, they swagger in, they do a bit of bard and rogue swagger in these relative dive bars.
Bard and rogue, that's really well put.
And sometimes they pull a gun, sometimes they just get away, and then they hop onto the next location until they kind of just catch up with the rest of the characters at the end of the plot. Like, it's fine.
Next location is absolutely right. There's a joke in a podcast I like called Kill James Bond, which is just where they say, and this is where James Bond goes to next location, because he just sort of gets maneuvered around the plot. And that is very much what happens here. Place to place to place, locale to locale to locale. start off City Planet, then Strange Base, then Underwater Casino, then back to Coruscant.
Now, there is something that does get brought up in their plot, though, that I do think is a bit interesting. And we talked about in our last episode, all these new characters, the struggle of democracy. And we have an annoying senator. Frailer?
Yes. So, last time we called him Phelan, but which is actually the name of the main character in A Court of Thorns and Roses. But I think his name is actually supposed to be Failure. Like Failia, but it's supposed to sound like failure, as in you're a fuck up.
Beautiful. Failure.
Which actually is a very George Lucas name. Darth Sidious. Failure. So it's a bit like a bit of a middle finger to the boffins. Yes, this is my son, Doomfuck.
Once you get over that Admiral Akbar is a Mon Calamari, you're like, fine.
It only occurred to me whilst reading this book. Admiral Akbar is a Mon Calamari. And he's like, his co-worker, a human woman, is called Mon Mothma. Surely that's got to be weird, right?
Yeah, it's Mon Mothma. Like, Mon, is that her title? Or her, like, first name?
I've assumed that it was her.
I've read way too much Star Wars to
she's
not know this yet.
She's only ever called Mon Mothma, though. Like, she's never Mon, and she's never Mothma, and she's neither Miss Mothma. It's always Mon Mothma.
And I definitely, I do think she eventually gets called, like, Chancellor Mon Mothma. Like, that is just her name.
I guess it's a weird situation. It's like when you have celebrities who go by one name. She's always just her full name. I guess that is what happens to most celebrities, actually. Like, you can't just say, Paul! You know, Paul! Anyway.
So, I don't know where I was going. Failure. Failure gets brought up again. So Failure is this Bothan character, and he's the antagonistic force within the Republic. And I really enjoy it in the first book, because he's not outwardly a villain.
No.
You know, he's just there to remind you of how annoying democracy is. People have differing opinions. Gets in the way of getting the job done.
Not a villain, but
an antagonist.
How are
you meant to fight a military campaign? Exactly, with these people around. But this book, I'm not going to lie, does tweak that a bit. He definitely shuffles from antagonist a little bit down into villain in this book. And I don't know if that's quite
thrilled at that. I totally agree. The point where he and Han Solo are walking along a corridor together is the peak of him as a character. Because up until this point, in this book, he doesn't really appear much. He is an antagonistic force because he's created all these problems. But he actually doesn't appear much in the narrative. And then Han Solo is marching down the corridor with him, and he directly confronts him and says, "You're making a mistake here. Your approach to politics is wrong." And it's not even a question of, like, you're too greedy, or you're just in it for yourself. Your philosophy is wrong, and you need to change that because you're not benefiting the Republic. And that's a really effective scene because he's unable to get through to this guy who has a very different perspective on what it means to do politics and to triumph. Because Failure's argument is basically just a bit of an extension of what is a very real perspective that actual politicians have, which is, I need to do what I need to do to get re-elected so I can do what I need to do. So I need to stay in power so I can keep doing my job, but in doing my job, I just keep staying in power. And it just takes it one step further, which is, I need to ascend in power and devour my colleagues and throw them down behind me, because that way I can get into power so I can do the things I need to do. And I like that scene. But the very next scene, it feels like it's a completely different character, with a completely different perspective.
Yes, it kind of moves. So at the start, it sort of straddles that line between selfishness and selflessness. It's like, yeah, I'm selfishly looking after my career, but it's only because eventually, one day, when I get there, when I win, then I'll be able to do all
because
the good I'm planning
great,
to do.
So but obviously, like, I need to get there be the best cost. When I'm in charge.
But then he just tips over. He basically goes from that to, oh no, I'm actually really just doing this for
myself.
And
more than that, he's like, friendship? There is no such thing as friendship. Camaraderie? No!
He goes into this anime villain mode where I really thought, like, Leia or Han would just turn around and be like, no, it's the power of our friendship that make us so good. Do you not understand?
That's right. For the honor of Grayskull!
And it's really disappointing because I think he was working towards a really nuanced point, and Star Wars is not necessarily the field for the most nuanced characters. Like, the Emperor is not nuanced. No. He doesn't need to be. He's fantastic as he is. But now we're expanding Star Wars. Now we're writing out like a full novel to dive into this world. And now that we have two other villains, mm-hmm. you know, Thrawn and Jorah Sabaoth, like, it would be nice to have another part of that kind of triangle of villainy.
I'll tell you what, man.
Have Thrawn...
I'll tell you what. I just realized something. You know what's a really great book for that? It's the Expanse novels. How many times in the Expanse novels is the villain someone who just goes a bit too far? Like, the third book, you see an almost exact same thing happen, which is that the villain goes just a little bit too crazy and his own followers turn on him. And so in this scene, that happens. He gets arrested by his own men and they join Leia. But it only happens after a... And to be honest, I'm a sucker for a scene where it's just, we turned on the radio and everyone heard you talk. I love that. But it is a bit cartoony. But no, there are really good books out there where you could have the villain be undermined by his own people because they realize, oh, this guy, he's not who we want to follow. And it just is, it's way too on the nose in this.
Completely. And it's a bit disappointing. I do enjoy, though, I love seeing, and I liked it in, like, Ahsoka as well. I liked it when people rebel against the good, air quotes there, institutes, when they're like, no, I don't believe in you anymore. Like, a government, and I think this is, Star Wars is great for it, because the government's born out of rebellion. Mm. So I like the idea that people are only kind of one step away from being like, I rebelled against the last government, I'll do it again if I don't like you. And I'm not saying that's good, or like that's good for the government, or like what the universe should be working towards in Star Wars. But I do like those scenes of people just kind of having them. I was like, no. Why? Why would we? We're the very people who stopped following the rules when we thought they weren't good. So surely we're going to keep doing this again. And this was like an extreme case of it, but it still had that kind of satisfaction when his own men are just like.
I found the quote. Don't be wait, hang on, I'll go from card. Is that true, counselor? All this talk about being on the side of a military is nothing more than a play for political power. Remember, they're on like a hot mic at this time, and Thalia doesn't know that. Don't be foolish, counselor. What other use are soldiers to a politician?
Just twirls his mustache as
Except
he goes.
His entire body is covered with hair. Do you know boffins are big dog men, Duncan? I didn't know that.
I only learnt that when I read, I think it was like the X-Wing comics for the first time, and they show up in that, and I'm like, oh, okay. Yeah. They've never appeared in actual live-action Star Wars,
no,
as far as I'm aware.
No, because they just look a bit like they're in a fursuit, wouldn't they? You need...
Well, probably. I'm sure you could do something nowadays where you could get around that
a
little bit.
Yeah, we have just CGI
stuff. Like Scooby-Doo from those early 2000s
films. Big rubbery puppets. You want your Star Wars aliens to look like big rubbery puppets or someone with prostheses on. That's why you have Zabrax and Rodians, because you just put a mask on someone. All those guys who have like their heads that go... they can go down and then up and they're a bit like a hammerhead. I love those guys.
It's always good to see them in more, like, action, particularly in the comics. And you're like, yeah, they're like when they're treated not like they're a guy in the suit and actually move about, you know, like they're living
Yeah, like, there's a scene in this where Chewbacca, like, really quickly climbs a pole. And I'm like, yeah, we could never see Chewbacca run and climb a pole. That would be ridiculous.
Do you ever feel, could Bothans get name-dropped in Return of the Jedi? Yeah. Do you think that Zorn got given a description, like, this is what we never filmed them, but this was the idea for what a Bothan looks like? Or do you think that's a Zorn original? I don't know the answer.
Oh, that's a great question. I think George Lucas, being a big world builder, probably either he had a plan the whole time, is like, yeah, Bothans, I have loads of ideas for Bothans, Or someone at one point said, George, many boffins died. What is a boffin? And he went, they're like big, hairy dog people. And they have really conniving politics. And they're like innately very bureaucratical.
I love your George Lucas voice.
Thank you.
Yeah, one of the two, I'm sure.
I really like cars.
There is actually a comic book called Tag and Binks. Have you heard of it? Star Wars?
Tag and Binks? No.
Absolutely fantastic. I recommend it to any Star Wars fans. It's a Legends comic. I don't think it was ever canon, really. And it retells the original trilogy, but from the perspective of two guys who are forever just off screen. Or they were on screen, but they were always either in some uniform or disguising themselves as stormtroopers in every moment. And in that version, it links back in. And it's like, if you watch the movies again, it's meant to be like the stormtrooper that's like escorting Chewbacca on Cloud City. It's like, that's Tag.
Okay.
And the guy that shoots Luke's hand on the Return of the Jedi on Jabba's cell bar, it's just like, that's Binks. But anyway, there's a scene in that where they meet many boffins. And it's just a bloke called Manny Boffins. It's like
Manny Boffins.
Like it.
No, not our guy. Not Manny. Oh, dang. It's always been weird to me how important Mon Mothma is to like all the extra canon stuff. A woman who appears in a singular scene.
I know. Classic kind of case of like, surely you would have showed up in the previous two movies if you were important.
Where's the guy with grey hair and a bowl cut who doesn't know how to pronounce Princess Leia? Shouldn't he be in charge?
I know. I always find it weird because, like, Ackbar doesn't appear, does he, until the Return of the Jedi? Am I right in saying that?
No, that's right. But just, he's super important as well. He's so important he invented the B-Wing.
Just gotta work his way down the alphabet. He'll get...
Listen. We covered a lot of the stuff we would talk about last time, so let's jump in on this. Y-Wing. X-Wing. What are they comparing them to? They don't... Their alphabet is a bunch of squiggly lines. They don't have Y's or X's or B's.
Oh, don't. Don't say that to me, Geordie. I'm having a freaking crisis here. Crisis of faith. What do they... I mean... An X... No, because it's an X, not even a cross. It's an X.
I'm looking to see if T-wings are a thing. I feel like they should be. Oh, that doesn't look like a T. That doesn't look like a T at all.
Well, that's my thoughts, because an A-wing doesn't look a lot like the letter A. So maybe...
It kind of does. It's because it's obviously it just has like a sort of sharp front to it.
It's going to be something where people... are going to be like, it's actually called the X-Wing because it uses the extraordinary flight formation.
Okay, do not look up the R-Wing.
I will not.
It just doesn't look like an R. So I'm going to describe this to you now, okay? I want to imagine the main body of an X-Wing, okay? So, you know, it's long and it's pointy, right?
Okay.
All right, now, instead of having those big X-Wings, they're smaller, all right? They're much smaller. I want you to imagine there are two of them. And just like with the X-Wing, they have, like, the cannons on the side, okay? On the tips.
Okay.
Now put it way at the back. The wings are at the very back of the Starfighter.
No. What?
Okay, so it's basically like, well, funnily enough, it's sort of a bit like... A Y shape, or like a... Oh no, like a champagne glass. Imagine a champagne glass, okay?
Okay, I see that.
Like that sort of shape, okay? Okay, now... So, obviously, the wings are flat. Now, you know how he said that the X-Wing... Like, it doesn't have the, like, spreading X-Wing wings? Well, it kind of does. But only on one side.
I'm sort of picturing something, I'm not gonna lie. That seems a little closer to what you see in, like, Star Fox. You ever play those games?
Yeah, I know what you mean. The Star Fox, yeah, I guess it's kind of close to that.
Right, Geordie, I must say, something that I do definitely feel is that once we get on the movies, I don't think ship design ever does quite hit the point. Like, I do have to be said, I think, like, original trilogy and even prequel trilogy, like, they had some of the cooler ship designs. The expanded universe, sorry to say it, I don't think we ever got something that really looked like right.
I completely agree. I completely agree.
At this moment, Duncan finally found a picture of an R-Wing.
Oh, yeah? That's not symmetric, and I don't like it.
Yeah, how would that even work? Like, you've got two propulsors on, like, the right-hand side of your ship. That means that the left-hand one would constantly have to be pushing out, like, twice the amount of power as the other two, and like that one's above the other two, so like the power, it would be constantly driving you downwards.
It also begs the question, like, if you had to make a quick turn, which side would you favor? Like, the side you would turn away from the side of the two thrusters. Very predictable.
Despicable.
Jordy, just to loop back around and close off this conversation, I have looked up why they call them X and Y.
Yep.
And did you not know that the original High Republic alphabet, used amongst the upper classes only, actually, by huge coincidence, is identical to our Latin alphabet?
That's fascinating.
That's genuinely all I've got. All right.
That means there's a limited number of starfighters they can make. You can only make, A, B, C, D, E, F, 26 of them. Then it has to be, it's the ampersand fighter. Watch out! It's the hashtag fighter! They're coming in!
My favourite is the Hammerhead from the Old Republic. Lovely cruiser.
I love the Hammerhead. Oh, wait, no. I'm thinking of the ones from the Rebellion. I have no idea what you're talking about.
I think they're the same, I think, but they originate from the Old Republic. They used to be the capital ships, and then they... I really like the scene in Rogue One where you see, like, a Hammerhead compared to a Star Destroyer, and you're like, that used to be the big ship.
I love the Star Cruiser. I love it. It looks so good.
Have you seen designs for the Katana fleet ships?
I have not, actually. I never bothered to look it up.
I'm not going to lie. Bit disappointing. Very thin cylinder kind of shape. Nothing exciting.
Ah, well. I think if we have to talk about if we're looking at anything about how starship designs change, it just has to be the fact that, like, like the rest of Star Wars' success, it was the collection of a couple of, like, genius artists working in London in the 1970s under the supervision of George Lucas, who invented all of these incredibly iconic things. And then after that, like, you're not talking about teams of skilled craftsmen working with something which is not merely beautiful to look at, but they feel practical. They feel like, yeah, this makes sense. This feels like something that would work because it had to slide down rails and it had to look like, yeah, this is something that could potentially fly. And then when you see something like, I forget what it is. No, it was a ship that Mara Jade flies in this. It's called, like, the Skid something. The Skip Ray. I looked it up. It's hideous. It's hideous and it doesn't look like anything that could ever fly.
No, completely. There's some additional designs in this, particularly for Lando's ship later on, which just looks so blocky. I'm like, where's the sleekness? Mm-hmm. Where's the... It looks like they've gone a little bit too far back to sort of older classic sci-fi for inspiration. And I don't think they get the vibe right. It's a hard thing to pull off. But I will say...
It is. You can't make something that's just instantly iconic. Something like that only happens once.
Oh well, Disney will keep trying. Back to the Dark Force Rising. So, we kind of got to the end, but I think we've actually missed out a huge factor here, which are those new characters again. They were a big part, we spoke loads about them in the last book. They're all back. Card,
Yeah.
Failure, as we already mentioned, but the main one that I want to talk to before we kind of wrap up is Mara Jade, because she gets a nice bit of content.
Yes, absolutely. She's so good in this book.
This character, obviously, massive fan favourite. She gets to do so much more now. Mm-hmm. Not only does she get to do more, we learn so much more about her. Jordy, why don't you just give us the lowdown? What is Mara Jade? Why should we care?
Yeah, so in the previous book, her backstory is laid out in basically the least interesting way possible, which is that she sat down with Luke and she explains her whole life story. And that is not great. It's not an interesting way. It's compact, it's dense, it gets it all out there nice and quick. But it's communicated so much better in this book, where you have little recollections, like Mara Jade meeting with Thrawn again. And up to this point, there's been no indication about whether they know each other or not. But when she shows up and they know each other and they have reputations and they have like a pre-existing relationship, that makes it so much more interesting because she has an account of her old life. Well, here comes someone from her own old life who can say, actually, no, you don't remember this correctly. You think you were the Emperor's Hand? You were a Emperor's Hand.
I love that scene so darn much.
Me too. That was great.
It not only sends the character for a spin, but our perception of her. And like to do that both kind of simultaneously.
Yes.
Oh, chef's kiss writing there.
And more than that, the meta look at her. Not just how she views herself, not just how we view her, but how we view our own viewing of her. Because last time I made a bunch of like slightly snarky jokes about OCs, about, you know, about DeviantArt, do not steal, this is my special cool Star Wars character. And in this book, oh no, she's not that special. She's competent, she's cool, but she's not the incredibly important and significant figure who just so happened to be off screen. She is one person who lived in this galaxy, who thought she was important, and actually turns out she's just like the rest of us. Very cool, very competent, very fun to read about going on space adventures. And I think that realization, even though it doesn't really shake Mara straight down to her core, I think it has a substantial reason behind what she does next. Card is captured because of her, and then who does she turn to for help? But Luke Skywalker, the person she wants to murder. That was my favorite part of the book. I actually sent it to you, like a picture of that thing being like, oh my God, I had a little jump for joy when I read that bit.
I think it's because it's not necessarily that she like loses her self-confidence and realization. I think it just makes her suddenly, it shakes her loyalty to her old life. It shakes the fate of her where she went, gosh, I had everything. And she just goes, oh God, I was also being treated a bit like shit in a very roundabouty way.
I don't think it's as much as that, but I don't think she is as rooted to what she has to be. Her sense of identity is warped from learning this, and therefore everything she attaches to who she was, it's no longer as strong. It doesn't have as great a hold on her anymore.
You're right there, because in that first book, she goes, I was the Hand, Luke Skywalker. This is what I was. This is what I am. And it's like, oh, that didn't ever really exist apart from in my own perspective. So how can I still follow that if I never truly was that? But yeah, she goes to find Luke Skywalker. Yeah.
And everything that follows after that.
Amazing.
And everything that follows after that is great.
The breakout scene.
Not only does she need, well, yes, that, but also the fact that she needs to get Luke's help, but Luke is being, like, hoodwinked by Joris Saboeth. So not only does she not kill Luke Skywalker, she saves him. She doesn't even really mean to, but she does.
It's really touching to see this fact that, like, they're kind of teaming up. Sort of almost against her own will.
Yes.
I mean, they are, sorry, let me rephrase that. They are teaming up because she wants to go and find Luke, but they're working together better than I think she would like them to.
It's so true. And it's a great sort of odd couple thing because they are a good team. They work well together. She's a bit snappy with him because, you know, she wants to murder him. But there's this great interplay between what they need to do. She's a slicer, which is a Star Wars version of a hacker, which my girlfriend was disgusted to learn. Why can't you just call it a hacker? Anyway, so she has to like do the R2-D2 thing and like put him in a trash compactor and close the walls on him. And he's like, oh my God, she could so easily kill me here. I've put myself completely at her mercy. I'll be squashed flat. But she doesn't. She saves him. She wants to break into a room and chop down some stormtroopers. And he's like, no, I'm learning how to be a Jedi. And I want to do this my way. And I'm going to use gentler methods, my mind manipulations.
Geordie, how much do you know about this character and where she goes in the EU?
Pretty much everything.
Okay, then. You watched a YouTube video long ago?
Yeah, exactly. I saw a YouTube video 8 years ago and I remember everything.
Fair enough. Do you know that wasn't really set in stone, though? There was a lot back and forth.
I'm sure that's true. I mean, this is one guy's idea of what it should be, but she's not in Dark Empire, so clearly she doesn't join the team immediately after this.
No, she not only does she like hang back and come in and out of stories, Luke gets other partners who other writers bring in. There's a character called Callista, who they try so hard to make Luke's like love interest and odd couple, like recreate him and Mira Jade's relationship. And there's even
just like Spider-Man.
Quite. And there's even a bit during the, I think it's the Corellian trilogy, where they try and team her up with Lando. And they're like, no, Lando and Mira, that's what's going to work. And I do think it was between two factors. One, general fan weight, and Timothy Zorn getting his hands back on it and being like, nope, I'm bringing you back.
All of my plans shall be complete.
And to not spoil what I'm dancing around, Mira Jade and Luke Skywalker, Mira Jade and Luke Skywalker, power couple, rest of the series, amazing. And started here, and shown really, really well. And this is a great prison break scene. I love a prison break.
Yeah, and it's a good one.
And in a weird way, because this is many respects, this is what was in the original Star Wars. They save Princess Leia. Trash compactors. It's really similar.
It actually genuinely feels like a second draft. Like Luke said, okay, I kind of screwed this up last time, but this time I think I can really pull it off.
And they somewhat do, and it's right under Thrawn's nose, and I really enjoy the fact that when Thrawn kind of gets wise to it, he's very quick to be like, okay, shut that down. There'll be a spice there. Go and check on Card immediately. We've got to stop this.
Here's what I love. The fuck up is completely on him. He's way too audacious. His plan, like, Pelion is like, he tells Pelion, shut down the main computer system. And that's like an extreme reaction. And it works to stop Mara Jade from doing her slicing. So good on you there, but it means like a whole bunch of systems aren't online. They can't even go to hyperspace. They can't use their tractor beams, and they get away because they can't use the tractor beams and they can't follow them into hyperspace. So it's literally his fuck up. And that's great, because that's genuinely the first true mistake he makes in the series.
And I really enjoy this mistake, because the way he sort of we get led into it, we as the reader, I'm very much, at least I was, led to believe, oh, this is him doing his awesome power play again.
Exactly.
You know, he's like, you shut up, I'm so in charge. Go for it.
Yeah. You've so bought into the myth of Thrawn, you've drunk the Kool-Aid, you completely believe in his powers because he's been infallible up till now, and then he screws up. He's wrong. Pelion probably could have caught them.
Yeah, my man Pelion. You keep going, boy.
Yeah, your favourite. Not much to speak of him in this book, I'm afraid.
No, many a book yet to go through.
Until he creates the... what's another super weapon you can do? The moon thrower. It uses gravitational forces to throw moons at planets.
No, oh gosh. I don't want to act too massive, but do you know what? We've always been a podcast that's kind of on spoilers, and loads of people listening to this probably aren't hitting the E for the first time, so I'm going to let in, do a 30 second skip, you'll clear this spoiler. My favourite Pelion moment is that he's the Imperial in the Spectres of the Past book, another Timothy Zorn book, right at the end of the New Republic era. He's the Imperial that eventually, that firstly goes, just kind of sits there and goes, he's testing out a new super weapon, it fucks up, and he literally just goes on his comm and go, someone messes the New Republic, we're going to surrender.
That's great. Oh.
And it's just this beautiful, like, he's just tried it all, and you can just see him in this in his office scene. He's just saying like, okay, I'll give up now. It's not worked again.
It was worth a try. It was worth a try. No more super weapons, guys. Do you hear me? No more super weapons. Oh my god, two things before we wrap up. Now, it does occur to me, Duncan, that the main thrust of this book is there is a collection of a lot of ships in one location, which is the same plot as Rise of Skywalker. And two, the much complained about Holdo maneuver appears in this book.
I mean, the first one, I think there's enough differences in the context. The Holdo maneuver.
Like, people were complaining a lot, like, that's not how ships work in Star Wars. That shouldn't work. You don't know anything about Star Wars. This has nothing to do with my opinions about women. It is exclusively a problem with the logistics of how space works in a fictional universe.
I never cared about that. It was a really cool visual.
I agree. It looked good, and I don't care about any of your stupid complaints.
But I do see, though, it does open the question, why don't we do that more often?
Because most people aren't kamikaze.
That's a good answer. It's a good thing they don't bring slave circuitry into normal Star Wars, though, because you would be like, why don't you just put...
Yeah, that would happen all the time. All the time. Like, I mean, let's put it this way. When did kamikazeing planes happen?
World War II, Japan.
When has it happened in war subsequently?
I'm going to go not to my knowledge.
Never. It's not a tactic that ever persisted. It's like an very unsuccessful thing. Like, it worked 20% of the time. So, yeah. Obviously, people wouldn't do this all the time because you just wouldn't do it. Because it just, people don't do it. They don't kill themselves.
Also, it works really well in that because she uses, like, a massive cruiser. They just don't have that many ships of that size.
To be honest, I think given the speed she's going as she enters pseudo-motion, it probably would work with, like, an X-Wing. Like, but nonetheless, yes. Most people are not going to be...
But you're right.
That movie has more problems than that one.
Classic example, anyway, though, of something which is in the old expanded EU, which is much praised... It does sort of play again. This is another thing where we talk about things like force healing, and you just go, yeah, we've had that in the video games for years.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know why anyone would have a problem with force healing. That feels like something they should have.
It is really interesting. I think the only issue is it makes you just sit there and go, gosh, they really could have used that in, like, a few instances. Qui-Gon just being like, you're okay. Sorry, Obi-Wan being like, you're okay to Qui-Gon.
Yeah.
But... That's what happens when you write a franchise over years.
I don't regret Qui-Gon dying, but...
It's a bit messy.
anyway, I think
we're getting near to the wrap-up on Dark Force Rising. This has been a really fun read, Geordie. I've already told you I've finished this trilogy. I read it all the way through. I read Last Command. It was really fun.
Yes, you have. You've already finished everything.
But, Geordie, we still got to pick a book for next time, Geordie. Do you know, what do you want to read?
Duncan, there's a lot of books out there that I'm very eager to read. However, this week, it's not my choice, it's yours.
Oh, yeah.
Now, people, it would be the funniest thing in the world for Duncan to not pick The Last Command and instead pick The Last Graduate, the next Scholomance book. So, Duncan... How funny do you want to be right now?
I am surely tempted, Geordie, but I'm not going to do that, mate. We're finishing this trilogy. I have set out to bring you into the fold of the Star Wars EU. And I do feel like if we can just finish this trilogy off, I think I'm going to leave it. I may never bring it to this podcast again because I know the seed will be firmly planted and I can just sit back and watch it grow.
You've already told me within this episode, like, let's put it this way. Within the course of this episode, you've told me, not only confirming the thing I already knew, that Mara Jade and Luke Skywalker are going to end up together, but you've also told me that so much time passes in the meantime where it's not going to happen, where they're going to run around in circles, and they're going to waste my time with plot elements that don't actually advance the story forward because it was being written by a bunch of different authors who weren't properly communicating with each other.
I mean, yes and no, but what I'm going to tell you is, for once you're reading Timothy Zorn, things move forward. He's got a firm hand on this.
One day, in a couple of years' time, the old canon Star Wars book club will have advanced far enough that I can listen to them for recommendations on which ones are worth reading. But until then, we'll be reading The Last Command by Timothy Zorn and wrapping up this trilogy.
I'm so looking forward to it, Geordie. This has been an absolute pleasure to not only review this book, but deep dive onto so much other Star Wars stuff as we go. If you've been listening and you have an opinion on Star Wars EU, the Star Wars franchise, Star Wars as a whole, this particular book, or Timothy Zorn as an author, or really just want to tell us when we were wrong, because I bet we were at places on Star Wars lore, then the best place to let us know is on our Instagram, It's Just a Fantasy Podcast. You can also reach out to us through our Gmail, This is Fantasy Just Podcast @gmail.com.
What's your favourite alphabet fighter? Are you an A-wing person, an X-wing? Are you a T-wing? A W-wing? I will say, Duncan, I really like, out of the sequels, all of the different TIE fighter versions you get. They look super cool.
They do. I was very, I don't want to say really disappointed in the sequels. That's not a new take. But I was a little bit, when I saw the sequels, the Force Awakens trailer for the first time, and they basically showed off just the X-wing again, I was a little bit like, could we just change it up a little? It's iconic, and they do make changes, but I was hoping for a bit more. Oh well.
I agree. My first love, BB-8. He'll never desert me.
Best thing of the films.
It genuinely is. That's the best part. BB-8 is the best part of this entire sequel trilogy. All right. I've been your host, Geordie Bailey.
I've been your other host, Duncan Nicol.
Bye-bye!
Bye!